Hey, hi everyone. It is December 11th, Hanukkah, and we're continuing. And I even see a private message to me. I have someone else other than David Eisen listening right now from Jerusalem. That's a big kavod. This is class number five on Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger, and we still need to deal with Auschwitz. Although maybe we'll finish. Well, we're going to finish hopefully the Bamberger Hirsch dispute, but then we're going to move it. I got to move it into the next generation, continue it with Germany, and then we're going to move into other areas also dealing with Auschwitz in Hungary, in the United States. We'll see what the Gadol HaDor of Chaim Moshe Grodzinski had to say about this dispute, and then we'll move back to other areas, Reb Bamberger's ideas, some of his tshuvot, and oh, and how Ritzvi Yehuda Cook made use of Reb Bamberger's shita. Okay, let me just respond to a couple of things. I listened to the class. You know, I said in discussing the status of the Reform community, the general community in Frankfurt, I called them Mesisumediach. At least that was the term that that was how Hirsch regarded them. And I started thinking afterwards. You know, although if you look online, if you Google it in English, everyone says Mesisumediach with the Seyre under the Mem. And I started wondering, though, is that correct? Should that be correct? Lo and behold, at least according to the Alkali dictionary I have on my desk, it actually should be Macy's Umadiach. He feel. So for those who want to be exact, I mentioned the unfortunate passing of my mother-in-law. In fact, if you listen to the tape, it's like I didn't really word it properly. I said something like, I'm happy to be able to tell everyone about this. What I meant is I felt fortunate that I was able to tell people listening throughout the broad expanses of the world so that they would at least know the unfortunate occurrence that happened. But I raised the issue of owning. Does an onein, does a woman who's an onein make the bracha on the Shabbos candles? And how it, I found it strange that this is not mentioned this in the standard sources. One of you, by the way, Mort, if you're with me, you texted that Maurice Lam says you don't. Well, I wrote it down and I checked Maurice Lam, at least the my book, Maurice Lam, he doesn't mention that at all. So, if you can confirm that. But some of you sent me things, and it seems that the majority opinion is that you do, the woman does make the bracha. However, I thank Elazar for sending me a sefer, the newly released Hilchos Aveilos HaShalem by Rabbi Zev Hofstadt. Never saw seen the book, but you sent me the page, and he paskens that a woman who's an oneid does light the Shabbos candles. And it's a dispute whether she makes a bracha. You know, my only question was, does she make the bracha on it? I never even asked, does she light it? I assume she lights it. I really should have asked the question, does she light it? But it seems that everyone holds she lights it, but I guess that also would be a question. Why would she light it? Isn't she putter? But as for the brachas, in this sefer, it quotes Rav Chaim Kanievsky that she is to lahadlik b'li bracha. And even though, well, our women Ashkenazic, we bake the bracha after lighting it. That's interesting that he says that, but that doesn't seem to be the standard approach. Thank you, Ben. Ben pointed out something which I had no idea about. I was talking about how in the Hirschian school, they would only have religious Jewish teachers for the secular subjects or non-Jewish teachers. And how in America, as far as I know, I even asked someone in the Haredi school who works in the Haredi school. He said that there is no such a thing. There's no such thing that in the Haredi school system that you won't hire a non-religious Jewish teacher.
Okay.
Muted.
I was wondering if it was just me. Mark, we don't hear you. Mark, we don't hear you. We can't hear you.
Now you can hear me?
Yeah, but so go back about a minute.
Okay, what was the last
You
thing you heard?
just finished It's in the Haredi school system, they're happy to hire non-religious teachers.
Okay,
That's
so I asked a
what
friend of mine who teaches at one of the high schools in Muncie, and he said there's no such concept where they don't have non-religious teachers teaching secular subjects. If anyone knows anything different, let me know. I'm curious, actually, does Breuers today, anyone know what Breuers in Washington Heights does? Because in Frankfurt, this was an absolute rule. I think in America, it might, well, it actually wouldn't be illegal, I don't think, because it's a religious institution. But I heard hear from Ben that he says that unlike the case in America, in the Mamarti-Dati schools, they officially ban that. A teacher, even a secular studies teacher in Israel, has to sign a declaration stating that he or she lives a Dati life, and the principal of the school has the right to fire any teacher for religious reasons. He says, I don't know how many schools strictly adhere to this. He says it's a great irony because the Mafdal was all about cooperation with the secular, but they refused to allow secular math teachers. The school system had to remain tahor. And he doesn't think that the parents would care if the teacher was secular. And he quotes for me the actual document from this. So thank you, Ben, very much for this because I had no idea. It says, Kol more nidrash lachatom ahatzara shehu mekayim orach chayim dati. Wow, that's really interesting. I guess it's the same reason that having a non-religious teacher will set up like a role model, give the kids another sort of possibility how they could lead their lives. I don't see how that works. Maybe David or someone else. Okay, you know what? Thank you, Morty. About I must have a different edition of the Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. There's been a few different editions because, but thank you for that. I will check if it's on a different page, but I looked. Well, I really don't understand the Mamarti-Dati school systems because all their children, at least the male children, are going to be going to the army. And there's no rule that the your army commander has to be religious, or maybe to make a distinction between elementary and high school and when you're older. I don't know. And again, thank you, Morty. So I guess Maurice Lam agrees with Chaim Kanievsky. Another thing I mistakenly said in the, I made the mistake, although I know the truth of this, but I don't know why. In speaking fast, I misspoke. But a lot of people, if you look online, a lot of people make this mistake. And I actually corrected the Wikipedia entry because I was curious how many people make this mistake. I refer to Jacob Rosenheim, one of the founders of the Agudas Yisrael from Frankfurt. He was the leader of the anti-Breuer forces as Rabbi Jacob Rosenheim. I can't tell you how many people refer to him as Rabbi Jacob Rosenheim, but he wasn't a rabbi. He was a balabas, a very fine balabas. The Agudas Yisrael gave him the title Moreinu for all that he did, but he was not a rabbi. He wasn't a halachic authority. He was a balabas who happened to write some interesting articles about Hirsch and other things. So I'm sorry to Yaakov Rosenheim, who lived a long and full life. He was in England, he was in America, he was in Eretz Yisrael, for removing from him the title of smicha, but he didn't have it. On the contrary, Yitzhak Breuer, known as Dr. Yitzhak Breuer, he happened to have received a heter hara, talis hara. So he got smicha, I guess you could say. That is not, as far as I know, written in any source, but I was told this specifically by his son, Professor Mordechai Breuer. And the final comment, thank you, Moshe. Moshe called my attention to something which I should have mentioned because it's of interest. Remember the dispute we spoke about between the Rambam and the Raivad? We begin last class. A kofar b'shogeg. You're a heretic, but you don't know any better. So the Rambam says he has no share in the world to come. And the Raivad, or Rabad, as my late teacher called him, Rabad, that's the title of his book, Rabad of Poskia, Rav Avram ben David, the Raivad, that after all, God is the one to determine whether you go to Olam Haba or not, and he can forgive you if you don't know any better. Moshe mentions that, there's a Rambam. Although in this dispute, Bamberger is setting himself up on the Raivad side. The Rambam himself in a tshuva says that with regard to the Karaites, he says that you can circumcise children of the Karaites. You are supposed to interact with them in a positive way. And he says that the statements of the Gemara are referring to the minim and how we have to destroy them. That's only if people are with chutzpah rejecting the law, but if they grow up this way, it's not their fault. They don't know any better. And if we give them honor and treat them well, maybe they can do tshuva. A lot of people have seen this tshuva of the Rambam as in contradiction to what he says in the Mishnah Torah, but it's not true at all. What he's talking about in the Mishnah Torah is share in the world to come. If you deny certain basic principles, you have no chayok and olam haba. That doesn't mean the Rambam would say if someone doesn't know any better, we treat him like a heretic. He's talking theologically. So you have Karaites, and although the Karaites, I guess they would violate the eighth principle because it deals with Torah Shabbat as well. But if they don't know any better, the Rambam is simply saying you have to, you don't have two hands pushing them away. You have to bring them close with one hand because it's not their fault. They've been raised that way. They're Tinuk Shenishba. This doesn't mean that the Rambam would say that this person has a share in the world to come. No, because share in the world to come is something entirely different. It's no different than if a Jew is raised by parents who indoctrinate him in idolatry. He doesn't know any better. So if you can reach out to him and try to bring him close, go ahead. But if you're not successful, it doesn't change the fact that he has no share in the world to come. I do, however, have to say, for the purposes of accuracy, I neglected to mention something last week that Rabbi Bomberger says, and I have to say, the Mechilas Kvodo, it's absolutely incorrect, and I think he didn't know the Morin Avuchim. Because after explaining the dispute between the Rambam and the Ravid, Rav Bamberger says, this is on page 237 of Collected Writings, even the Rambam can be interpreted in accord with the Ravid. This is a view that's been expressed by a few, not many, in which that when the Rambam says, we read it last week, that if you think that God has a physical form, you're a heretic. And the heretic is obviously one who has no share in the world to come, that it's not referring to someone who doesn't know any better. It's referring to someone who knows the Torah's teaching, but chooses to reject it. Now, apart from the fact that that's not really, it's hard to read that into the language of the Rambam, and the Ravid obviously didn't believe it, and all the Rishonim who line up on this dispute, either for the Rambam or against the Rambam, those who adopt for Chaim Soloveitchik's position, Nebuchadnezzar HaBikaris, HaBikaris, or the ones who defend the Rambam, like Abarbanel says the Rambam is obviously correct, because otherwise every idolater could say they don't know any better. So they all understood the Rambam to be arguing that an unwitting heretic is still a heretic. And it fits in with the Rambam's whole philosophy that the world to come is a natural process, that it's not a reward. It's after you die, your soul either lives on or doesn't live on. For the Ravid, God gives you the world to come, so he can decide to give it or not. However, this you don't even need to argue about this because the Rambam is explicit in Morin Nevuchim, Book 1, Section 1, Chapter 36, and I can only say that Rav Bamberger didn't know this Morin Nevuchim, because the Rambam says as follows: If you're and this passage, which I'm going to read to you now, in Rav Kafach's edition of the Morin Nevuchim, in his note, he said that the Rambam must have seen the criticisms of the Ravid, and he's responding to it because the Rambam says, if it should occur to you that one who believes in the corporeality of God should be excused because he was brought up in this doctrine. And he doesn't know any better, which is exactly what the Bamberger says. The Rambam says, no, it's not true, because then you should say the same thing about an idolater. And he goes on and says, it's not true. And he says that if you didn't know any better, you should have learned the truth and should have attached yourself to scholars who knew the truth. He says that, okay, he says, we have unkulos and they should teach you the truth. So the Rambam explicitly rejects this idea of the Ravid, that you could believe in a heresy. In this case, well, the Ravid might not have thought it'd be a heresy. Ravid might have just thought it was an incorrect belief. But the Rambam thinks it's heresy, and he says this notion that you can believe in it and you can be excused because you don't know any better, he explicitly rejects that. So with all due respect to Rav Bamberger, his position of trying to make even the Rambam agree with the Ravid, I gather that would make it a stronger case, because then it's one thing to say, well, I'm holding like the Ravid, but the Rambam disagrees. It's not, I feel comfortable in stating that this isn't a question of interpretation. Sometimes it's a question of interpretation. This is a factual thing because the Rambam himself says it explicitly. Okay, my friends, let us pick up. If you recall last week, the last thing I said, I believe, I was talking about how very few people actually followed Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's lead and withdraw from the general community. It isn't just his lead. He ruled you're obligated to. So here you have all these people in shul. And they choose not to listen to the rabbis. So don't let them tell you that it's only today our people don't listen to the rabbi. Throughout history, we know people haven't listened to the rabbi about lots of things, but these are people in his own shul, and they're not listening to him. And I want to give you the numbers. Actually, there's three types of people in the Frankfurt community after the Bamberger Compromise or the Moshe Mainz Compromise. You have the people who leave the community entirely, the general community, and just are members of the Hirschian community. Rav Moshe Mainz was involved in negotiations with the community, and he arranged a whole thing that it was like on paper that the people who withdraw their tax money would not go. It's not like that they just pay taxes and you could say, well, because we're the minority, our tax money doesn't go to support the reform institutions. It was actually on paper that the tax money from Moshe Mainz would only be directed to Orthodox institutions. Now, money's fungible, so you could say, well, what's the difference really? But they thought it was important, and this is what Bamberger thought also, to make it actually formalized. Would that change the halacha? As I said, if you're the minority, if let's say the reformer, let's say 80%, and you're 20%, you can always say that your money is going to the Orthodox. But at least the way Moshe Mainz worked it out, and I think Bamberger, this is what he insisted on also. I haven't found an explicit statement that he insisted that you have to do this, but he spoke to Moshe Mainz, and this was Moshe Mainz's idea, and so that's the compromise that he was giving his hascama to, as far as I could see. But he never actually says you have to have this form. He just says if the community builds a synagogue, doesn't interfere, all these sorts of things. But this is what Reb Bamberger was referring to, and I think we can see that from something else later. And then there's the people, and these are the majority, who just continued giving tax, the being members of the general community, didn't do a thing, didn't fill out a separate form saying that now we're members of the general community, but we want it to be known that we're Orthodox members, so our money doesn't go to any reform things. I want to read you the figures here, and now you can understand why it was such a great failure. The Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who changed German Orthodoxy, who saved German Orthodoxy. I don't think it's exaggerating to say that Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's ideology saved German Orthodoxy. And with all due respect to Rav Bamberger, who was a great, great posek, Rav Bamberger's type of Judaism would not have saved Torah Judaism in Germany for reasons I'll say in a minute. And that's why I think Hirsch gets so annoyed with him. You'll see something Hirsch says I'll share with you in a minute. But and Torah in Derech Eretz, in the Hirschian sense, becomes very, very popular. But Auschwitz, yeah, I think I counted 9 or 10 communities that had this, and they were always the minority. Most Jews refused to withdraw from the general community. But listen to the numbers in Hirsch's own community. You'd think at least in his own community, he'd have a majority at least. But no, I have the numbers in Robert Liberalis's book, Religious Conflict in Social Context. He has a whole long chapter dealing with. I mean, the subtitle is The Resurgence of Orthodox Judaism in Frankfurt, 1838-1877. So 1877 is the year of the great dispute between Bamberger and Hirsch. That's where it ends. But I have the numbers, and listen to this. There were approximately 360 members of the Hirschian community, that is, who paid taxes to this separatist community at the same time they paid to the general community. Then the law has changed in the parliament. 75 secede, like Hirsch. And we heard last class someone mentioning the Yafet article, though, which mentioned a lot of these people had connections to Hirsch, financial connections to the community. 70 accepted the compromise. That is, that you actually fill out a document stating that my money doesn't go to the reform. And 200, so that's 75 and 70, that's 145, and 200 didn't do anything. just remained the way they were, paying taxes to both communities. And I have to say, from reading Bamberger's, although Bamberger, I mean, he loved Ramosha Mainz, and he affirmed him. So I think he's clearly saying that this is what you should do. But if you read Bamberger's letter, he never actually says you have to fill out such a form. He says, like we spoke about, if the community is going to have no involvement whatsoever in the Orthodox community, the general community, if the Orthodox community can hire their own rabbi, run their own synagogue, then you don't need to withdraw. He doesn't add this extra consideration. He doesn't make it like halacha lemaisa that you have to do this. And they didn't do it, and this didn't become this wasn't the general practice. Now, in his attack on Bamberger's ruling, I'm going to get back to it because in the Klugman book, he wants to argue that those 200 people who didn't follow Moshe Mainz's path of that actual formal declaration, that they were violating Bamberger's ruling. I don't think so. And Klugman says something which is absolutely incorrect, as far as I'm concerned, which I'll read in a few minutes. But in his attack on Bamberger, the first attack, remember, Bamberger issues his statement that since the community is making all the compromises, you don't need to withdraw. And by the way, the Bamberger situation is the same situation you have in Israel now that all the Agudas Yisrael don't have an issue with. You're a member of a community. You pay taxes. The tax money goes. It goes to the Orthodox community to fund the schools, the mikveh, everything. And it also funds the secular schools that are teaching Kfirah. And yet, but yet the, in the Israeli government, Torah education, there's like in the Board of Department of Education there, you have a, or whatever they call it, you have the secular tract, the religious tract, and the religious tract is only controlled by religious Jews, people whose job it is to make sure that the schools are doing what they're doing, and there's no interference by people saying, well, you can't teach Torah Shebaal Peh, you can't do this. So the situation in Israel is the ex
Okay, you're muted again. I don't know if. No, you're still muted. Still don't hear you.
I don't know what the problem is here. I'm using the same mechanism I always use. Maybe my I have this portable microphone and lets me hear speak better, but I think it's a much better sound when I just speak into the computer. But if it's a problem, I'll have to buy a new one of these. Maybe something's wrong with it. As I was saying, is the situation in Israel is basically the same in as in Bamberger's time. It's granted, it's a country. It's not a community, but it's the same thing. The other than the small Eda Haredit, the Agudas Yisrael never said we have to withdraw when the state of Israel was formed. And tax money, yeah, you can assume, although it will be a problem. What are they going to do? What's the Orthodox going to do in Israel, the Aguda? Let's say they're the majority, as the predictions are with the demography, they will be. Then there's going to be a real problem. Because if you're 60% of the population and you're paying taxes to the state of Israel, and that tax money is going to support public schools that are teaching heretical stuff, what's going to be the justification for Agudas Yisrael paying taxes? If what they're going to do is they're going to work out a system like Ramosha Mainz did it, where they're going to say that our money is only going to go to the Orthodox schools. They'll come up with something like that, but they're not going to withdraw. So you see that historically, the Bamberger position, and as I mentioned already, that was the position all of the communities in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Lithuania, they all were in one community. Okay, but so Bamberger gives his statement. Hirsch attacks it. Now, in Hirsch's attack against Bamberger, he says that, well, Bamberger, we're not surprised you would come out against us because you oppose Torah im Derech Eretz, and we're a Torah im Derech Eretz community. And we saw Bamberger's response saying he doesn't oppose Torah im Derech Eretz, he only opposes it the way Hirsch sees it, but he thinks it's okay to have secular education. Now, in his first attack against Bamberger, Hirsch says he waxes eloquent, I should say, of how wonderful the Frankfurt Gehillah is, how it's a success. A Torah im Derech Eretz success, and it's the only thing that can bring continuity to Orthodoxy in Germany. Let me read you a couple of things. And then we got to ask yourself, why is Hirsch mentioning this? What's the relevance? So, for instance, on page 221, this is Collected Writings of Volume 6, Hirsch says that our community has demonstrated its courage, born of trust in God and its selfless, inspired devotion to Torah to Judaism. By the way, I think Rabbi Kelman, I don't know if he's with us. He turned the screen off. If for some reason my sound goes out again, just someone scream out. He says it's created institutions for Torah and Avodah that have won it respect. It set a shining example. It attests most cogently to the truth of the saving and healing principle of Torah and Derech Eretz, with which our community, Religionsgesellschaft, wrote upon its banner at the time of its establishment. And then he says that you are not, to you, Rabbi Bomberger, you're not altogether in favor of this principle. And then he says, let's assume that due to the effects of your pronouncement, Rabbi Bomberger, you say that we don't need to withdraw from the general community. He says, if that, he says that might lead to the destruction of our community, and the darkness of old would be back again, and Torah to Judaism would once again now be subject to the discrimination of the Reform Board of Trustees. So what Hirsch is saying to him is that if now the people don't choose to join our community, and the community disappears, all the compromises with the general community gave will be out the window, and they'll persecute the Orthodox again. He says our school will be closed, where thousands of young Jewish souls have been educated for Torah and Derech Eretz. It's not clear why. I mean, if when you didn't need to separate from the community, the school was a vibrant community, why should anything change now when you're given the permission to separate? On the contrary, you might want to say his community had more money, because the people who separate now, instead of paying double taxation, they'll be able to give extra money to the community. The whole thing doesn't make sense, what Hirsch is saying. And he goes on and on that we're going to see the disappearance of religious Jews, of religious Jewish men and women. He says educated Jewish women will no longer be ashamed to carry handkerchiefs and umbrellas on the Shabbos. He says to Bamberger, because of what you're doing, it really is. I mean, it's absurd, I have to say, with all respect to Hirsch. And I see why Bamberger was so offended by this, because, well, what does one thing have to do with the other? Why now? Because Bamberger issues his ruling that now Jews are going to start carrying on Shabbos? Well, what does one thing have to do with the other? He sees this. What he, the thing is, he sees the way Hirsch is portraying it is that once Bamberger gives a heter for staying in the general community, when you have a choice, then all the people who are in Hirsch's community will decide that they don't need to be in Hirsch's community anymore. They only were in Hirsch's community because they need an Orthodox community, and they were in the general community because they had no choice. But now that the Godel Hador in Germany says that you don't need to separate, well, fine, we can have a general community. We can have an Orthodox community, a general community. We don't need to be a member of Hirsch's community anymore. Why pay double taxation? But as I said, it's absurd, his point. Maybe at the time he wrote it, it wasn't, but it was obvious that the people, they didn't do that. They remained part of Hirsch's community, because the fact is that they still were committed to an independent orthodoxy. And that's the whole reason why they joined in the first place. Let's not forget, there always was an Orthodox shul in Frankfurt. And but okay, maybe I'm being a little harsh on Hirsch to say it was absurd, because thinking from Hirsch's perspective, if now the general community creates an entire Orthodox community, independent, no interference with their own rabbi, you could see that a lot of people would say, at least Hirsch was afraid, they would say, what do I need to be a member of Hirsch's community anymore? Just go back to the general community, save some money on taxation. In the end, it turned out to be absurd that Hirsch was not judging his people fairly, because he assumed that he'd lose a lot of them. It turns out they didn't lose them. They remained loyal to him, and they remained loyal. They just like they paid double taxation before, most of them continued paying double taxation afterwards. But I mean, I can see why Bomberger would be upset, because he's saying basically, Bomberger, you're going to be responsible for destroying our community. But that's what he says for like four paragraphs. And then he says, these are some sketches of the calamity which you may have initiated with your statement. But after saying all this stuff, then Hirsch turns around. It's amazing. I don't know how he could write this. And says, but you need not worry, because all the foregoing was only an imaginary sketch of what might happen. Thank God, not even the faintest trace of that sketch will ever become reality, because our people are too firmly embedded in Torah, Judaism, etc. In other words, he has four paragraphs talking about this doomsday scenario, which I did say is really absurd. And in the end, here, and then I tried to justify it. But in the end, really, Hirsch himself says, you know, Bamberger, it really is absurd, because our people are so committed that they wouldn't, even if they didn't have to, they wouldn't leave our community. So I ask, what's the point of the four paragraphs in which he sets out this doomsday scenario if at the end he concludes that none of this is ever going to happen and can never happen? I don't understand it. It's like it's a gambit. It's like a it's a debater's game, it seems. He throws out all these things, and then he says that it's never going to happen. So if I'm Bamberger sitting here, I'm thinking, why are we playing these games here? We both know, and you yourself acknowledge that it's not going to affect your community. So I can't explain this. If anyone can, please let me know. And then he says that our community will say to all those who envy us that even this latest bitter experience, even your statement, Rabbi Bamberger, which no thinking person could have thought possible, will only work for us l'tova. It will purify and strengthen us. So if you're looking at the Hirsch back and forth, Hirsch really begins it in his open letter here. He what can I say? He chooses to go after Bamberger in a very harsh way. So understandably, Bamberger, we saw last class, Bamberger goes after him and pulls rank. Well, you know, I'm the gadol in halacha here, not you. All I can say is that we see how hurt Hirsch was and how betrayed he felt. Remember, Bamberger comes to Frankfurt to support the Hirschians. And once he's there, he comes out against them. How could Hirsch not see this as a betrayal? On the other hand, Bamberger tells us that he said to the people who come to, they come, came to Würzburg, they asked him to come to Frankfurt. He says, I can't come there. What am I? They asked him to make a decision. He said, how can I make a decision? I don't know. Well, I don't know the situation. So they say, well, then come to us. And at first he doesn't want to, but they say, you know, we came all the way to Würzburg. It's not such an easy trip in those days. So he says, I agree to come, but he says that when I go there, of course, I'm going to speak to the other side. And when I speak to the other side, I get a full understanding. Maybe who knows what I'm going to decide. So I see why Bamberger was upset with this language. Now, that's not all that Hirsch says, because in Hirsch's reply to Bamberger's letter, he goes further. He says that when it comes to Torim Derech Eretz, that's an educational principle that fine, maybe you, Bamberger, don't share. But Torim Derech Eretz is also related to the concept of Derech Eretz. Torim Derech Eretz, he says, has nothing to do with the concept of Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz, Torim Derech Eretz means Torah and Western civilization. Derech Eretz, we know what Derech Eretz means. And he says, how you, Rabbi Bamberger, could commit a blatant violation of the concept of Derech Eretz. Hirsch is accusing Rabbi Bamberger of not having basic Derech Eretz. I mean, well, there's stuff I'm not reading. I just want to tell you how impressed I am that the Hirschian society would translate this. Because from our perspective, 150 years later, it's tough to read this, because these are Gedolei Yisrael, and they're really the way they're arguing with each other. I know we have this expression that the Torah disputes, you know, the fervor, the excitement. People say things sometimes. The Raivad says things about the Rambam, but these were people who had a good relationship before that, and these were not private letters. These were letters for the entire world to see, and you know, what Bamberger says and what Hirsch says back and forth. It's not high ground, in my opinion. I don't know. What am I going to tell you? It's here, though. But this point about Derech Eretz is of interest, because I once gave a talk. I gave a talk at the Shul Kadimut. I just identified the shul, so I'm not going to go into the details. Let's just say that someone in the audience didn't understand what I was speaking of. What Rabbi Hapfinger asked me to speak about was the rejection in the yeshiva world of Torah and Derech Eretz. So I gave a whole talk about Torah and Derech Eretz, why the yeshiva world never accepted Torah and Derech Eretz. And one of the people listening to the talk, I never translated and explained what Torah and Derech Eretz meant at the beginning of the talk. So this person is listening the whole time and is thinking that I'm speaking about how the yeshiva world rejects Torah with, and also good behavior, Derech Eretz, respect, all the, you know, decency, dignity. So afterwards, the person comes up to me with their health finger and for about a minute rebuking me. How dare I say that the yeshiva world doesn't have Torah and Derech Eretz? And we didn't understand what the person was saying. What do you mean? How dare I say? They themselves say that. But then it became clear that this person didn't understand Torah and Derech Eretz as Torah with Western civilization. The person thought that for 45 minutes, I was talking how the yeshiva world has no Derech Eretz. And this person had a family member in the yeshiva, whatever. So you have to explain. And so here says, yes, Bomberger, you might not follow our approach to Torah in Derech Eretz, but there's another concept called Derech Eretz, and everyone has to follow this, and you don't follow this with what you've done here. And then he says, he rejects the idea that just because Bomberger is greater than him, that he can refute what he says. He says that even if it was just a question about a chicken, the broken wing of a chicken, if I gave a psak and you came to town, you can't interfere with that. That's a dispute. I mean, I don't know how to solve this. So Rabbi Bomberger says, yes, I can dispute with that, especially under the circumstances your people asked me to come. And Rabbi Bomberger says that, and they dispute. Each one can cite sources. Rabbi Bomberger says that if I'm greater, I mean, let's be realistic here. If your local rabbi says something, now here she's not a local rabbi. He's greater than a local rabbi. But just the point still stands. If the local Rav gives a psak, you're telling me that, let's say in Eastern Europe, if the local Rav Paskin that this is usser, that this chicken is treif, and then Ravitz Al-Khanan comes to town, and Ravitz Al-Khanan, the person shows Ravitz Al-Khanan, Ravitz Al-Khanan says it's not treif, that, you know, you can't listen to Ravitz Al-Khanan. I told you I saw this with my own eyes, with Rav Hershel Schechter and a community rabbi. Community rabbi who gives Rav Hershel all the respect in the world, even speaking third person, does the Rosh Hashiva this, the Rosh Hashiva that. Someone in the audience, it seems that the rabbi had told people that on Yom Kippur they can't use the Listerine strips. So someone, Rav Schechter would come to my town. He still does it, but not as much, maybe twice a year, ask the rabbi. It's sort of like a dangerous, subversive thing. What do you mean, ask the rabbi? We have a local rabbi. So when you bring in Rav Schechter like 2 weeks before Pesach and it's ask the rabbi, you're just looking for trouble because he could ask a question. He could answer something in opposition to what the local rabbi said. And obviously the assumption is that you go by Rav Schechter. Otherwise, he's the great posek. Otherwise, you wouldn't bring him in to begin with. So I guess you could say the local rabbi is being mochel. But... So the rabbi was asked the Rav Schechter was asked, and he gave his opinion. Many of you probably know this, that he holds that in Yom Kippur you can use Listerine strips. And the local rabbi sort of challenged him with respect. Are you sure with this? And who's everyone going to – look, the local rabbi was Mavatel, his opinion. But if the local rabbi – if after Rav Schechter left, the local rabbi said, you know, it's a difficult opinion, I don't hold of it – you can understand that everyone in the audience, their attitude is going to be like, well, you know, he's our great posek, Rav Schechter. Why shouldn't I listen to him? So that's, I don't know how to solve this problem. But then Hirsch says something else, which is very important. And this is a criticism, perhaps I think a valid criticism of Rav Bomberger, because then he says that, you know, we said that even with a chicken, he can't contradict the local Rav. But he says, but a chicken, Hirsch grants that a chicken, he says, the laws of a chicken are the same everywhere, in Frankfurt, Würzburg, New York, and New Zealand. So, okay, so if, you know, Bomberger's a greater posek, it's like as as a debater's strategy, he's acknowledging that, okay, all these are the same. They're the same halachos. If you don't want to accept what I said, that you can't override me in that case. He says, but in dealing with this case, the conditions that we're dealing with and on which you base your hetter, he said, can only be adequately known and judged by persons living there. A Baal Hara from out of town simply is not able. He doesn't have the facts. So he says to Rabbi Bamberger, how can you decide this matter? Now, what did Rabbi Bamberger do? He came, he listened to Rav Moshe Mainz, who described it, and then he gave his psak. But if I'm Hirsch, I'm saying, well, that doesn't give you the knowledge. For an hour, it was explained to you something, and now you're giving a psak. I've lived here my whole life. I see what's going on. And I think the greatest proof that Hirsch could give that Bamberger was misled and didn't know the facts, as we say, the metzius, is because remember, Bamberger said that since the Reform community is making all these compromises, allowing you to build a shul and get a rabbi, that shows they're not real heretics. They don't have the status of heretics. They believe heresy, but they're people who don't know any better, people with good intentions who are just misled. And, I'm thinking Rosh Hashanah Hirsch is saying, what are you talking about? Not even 5 years ago, 6 months ago, before the secession law was passed, these are the same people who refuse to allow orthodoxy to thrive here, who have engaged in all sorts of discrimination and preferential treatment for the reformers at the expense. And now they're willing to do this? They're willing to do this because they want to lose the tax money. And yet Bamberger is portraying them as like Tinok Shenishba. People don't know any better. Can anyone doubt that Hirsch is correct on the Metzius? We all know why the Reform made that compromise. So yes, maybe Bamberger would say we don't care really their motivations. It's all their actions. The Vorim Shebelev Inran Vorim. But Bamberger says in his letter, he says that from their actions we can judge who they are. That they that we put them in this status. That they show that they want the good for the Orthodox community. It's like naive the way Bamberger describes these reformers. So I think that's a strong point of Hirsch, and wait till you see how Rav Chaim Ozer uses this point. And okay, so that's all I want to say about Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch's response, and except for the point about Turing Derech Eretz. Look, in his response, Hirsch says to him, and he stresses it, he repeats the second time that our community is a Turing Derech Eretz community, which you don't share this the ideology of it. And he speaks about the young generation in Frankfurt who's been raised on Turing Derech Eretz, and they're the future of Orthodoxy. Why throw this in as a rabbinic expression? Ma inyan shmita etzel har Sinai. They're talking about what in Hirsch's mind is a halachic dispute. Must you separate or not? Why throw in this business that we're a Torah and Derech Eretz community? You don't like Torah and Derech Eretz the way we do it. That's why you're prejudiced against us. Where's the proof for that? What's the point? What's he saying it? Yaakov Katz, who knows this world very, very well. First of all, he's not from there. He's from Hungary, but he lived in Frankfurt for a number of years. That's where he got his degree from. He was very close to the Hirschian community. He got his smicha from the Hirschian the Hirschian yeshiva there. He wrote this book also, House Divided: Orthodoxy and Schism in 19th Century European Jewry. Most of it deals with Hungary, but a very long chapter, a very insightful chapter dealing with Germany. And then in this book, Torah im Derech Eretz, Hatznua, Isha, Rainotah, that is the movement, its personalities and its ideas, edited by Mordechai Boyer. It begins with an essay by Katz on Hirsch, from the right and from the left, the perspectives of Hirsch. And he raises the question I just did, and he points out a fascinating thing. He says, first of all, the way he describes it is as follows. Hirsch is sitting in Frankfurt. He's looking at Germany. Germany is majority in the big cities now. They're all reformed. Frankfurt, Ir Ve'Em be'Yisrael, a center of Gedolei Yisrael, is now controlled by the reformers. What Hirsch is saying, because Hirsch has now started this new Torah Derech Eretz movement to provide a future and an essence for Orthodoxy. What he's saying is that only Torah in Derech Eretz Jews understand the importance of what they're trying to do in Frankfurt. Only those who've been raised in accordance with Torah Derech Eretz principles can see how vital it is to separate from the reformers. Bamberger, an old-fashioned rabbi, he apparently doesn't see the problem if an Orthodox and a Reform sit together to talk about the hospital. And from Hirsch's standpoint, just sitting together with them, creates a toxic environment, and slowly Orthodoxy is broken down. That is, in order to have a proper Orthodoxy, you need to have complete separation. And you know who understands this? Only sophisticated modern Jews. The old-fashioned Jews, they don't get it. Bamberger is old-fashioned. Remember, and this is me speaking, not Katz here. It was under the old-fashioned rabbis that Orthodoxy, that Reform was allowed to triumph. How is it that in two generations they went from Orthodox dominated to Reform dominated? It happened because it was under the watch of the old-fashioned rabbis. If these old-fashioned rabbis, Bamberger included, had been college quarterback, had been college coaches, football coaches, or pro, they would have been fired because this happened under their watch. It's the old-fashioned rabbis, because they didn't understand the principle of Torah Derech Eretz, they allowed the Reform to triumph. They're the ones who are going to be telling us now how we're supposed to live, to have an Orthodox community. They're responsible for losing Orthodoxy. And you know why they lost it, according to Hirsch? Because they didn't understand the principle of Torah Derech Eretz. Torah Derech Eretz means that Torah must coexist with every civilization, and it must know how to relate to every civilization. It must dominate every civilization, and it must have a relationship with every civilization. But the Torah in Derech Eretz, you can't be in Frankfurt in 1850 and your Torah is going to be the same when the Derech Eretz was 18th century Vilna or Warsaw. Every generation, Torah needs to relate to the Derech Eretz in a different way. The Torah remains the same, the essence, but the way it's preached, it's manifested, all these things are different. Obviously, you can't be in Frankfurt in 1850, for instance, and give people a school system like they had in 1600 Lublin. So these rabbis who didn't understand Torah Derech Eretz, they're the ones who allowed the Reform to triumph. Had they understood Torah Derech Eretz in the early part of the 19th century, then, as the rabbinic expression is, they could have had the refuah before the makkah. They could have prepared the Orthodox Jews. Instead, they didn't. Traditional Jews were old-fashioned Jews without secular educations, and all of a sudden, Reform comes on the scene, offering a new type of Jew where you can go to the university, and traditional Judaism was left behind. When Hirsch comes in, he inserts Torah Derech Eretz, then very little attrition, because this ninth Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Torah Derech Eretz is the only type of Judaism that can succeed in 19th century Germany. It can't succeed in 19th century Poland, and it can't succeed in 21st century America. Obviously, it needs to be updated. But Hirsch's point was that rabbis like Bamberger, basically saying they have no business commenting on this matter of separatism or not, because they had their chance and they lost. And now I, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, is telling you that this is the way to keep Orthodoxy strong. And only people who understand Torah and Derech Eretz, that who are sophisticated in Torah and also in secular world understanding, can see why this is vital. It wouldn't have been vital 200 years before, but now, because you didn't have reformers. But now you have reformers, so you need Torah and Derech Eretz, and you need separatism. Both of these are vital for the community. These are the two major principles of Hirsch, and they're connected. They go together. You can't have one without the other, as far as Hirsch was concerned. Now, German Orthodoxy did think you could have one with the other. They took the Torah Derech Eretz and they jettisoned the separatism for the most part. But as far as Hirsch was concerned, if you are a real Torah Derech Eretz Jew, then you understand how vital separatism is. because you're sophisticated and you know that any organizational connection with heretical types of Judaism is going to have a negative impact. And that's according to Katz, that is why this is mentioned. It's on pages 15 to 16. He says, this is Katz's words, the nation, the dor, the generation which is educated, lor ha'ikaron shel Torah and Derech Eretz, in accordance with the principle of Torah and Derech Eretz, shelo k'zikne ha'dor ha'sharmani, not like the old-fashioned traditional generation in the past. They will yavin gam l'chashivut ha'ikaron shel ha'prisha. They're the ones, and only they are the ones that can understand why it's so important to separate. So that Katz makes a good case that that's the significance here of throwing in about Torim Derech Eretz. He says that we can leave that now. I want to mention make a few other points though. The difference between, remember, Bamberger doesn't oppose separatism per se in general. And even for in Frankfurt, he never said you shouldn't separate. We're going to see that there were Orthodox Jews in the next generation who were philosophically opposed to separatism. Bamberger is not. What he always says is that you don't have to. And at other times, in other communities, he said you do have to. The difference is for Hirsch, separatism, I think it's fair to say, is the first resort. For Bamberger, it's the last resort. The same point was made about Frankfurt versus Berlin. In Berlin, they had a separatist community also, the Adas Yisrael in Berlin. That was Hildesheimer's community. And as one, some, as I think it was Rabbi Moshe Auerbach, from this Berlin separatist community, as he put it, when the law, he said in Berlin, the attitude was, oi, woe is us, that we have to separate from the irreligious. Whereas in Frankfurt, the attitude was how great it is that we have the opportunity to separate from it. In other words, you can look at separatism as a last resort. And like I said, oyanu, woe is us that we have to separate. Or you can look at it as ashreinu shezachinu, how great it is that we now are finally able to separate. Hirsch, he saw this as a positive and pushed it, whereas in other places, it was sort of a necessary evil. Let's see. There's two more things on this matter I want to do, but I see the hour's late, so I'll hold off on them to next class and I'll skip ahead. I want to discuss, first of all, the Maharam Shik. The Maharam Shik is going to get involved in this dispute also, Rav Moshe Shik, one of the real Gedol Yisrael. And I want to share with you and something that is in this book by Klugman, Rabbi Eliel Meir Klugman. I don't know his connection. I mean, he's obviously from this community. I don't know if he grew up in Washington Heights or it's his grandparents are from there. As maybe some of you, Naftali, might know his details. It happens to be an excellent book. I am going to offer a criticism of a point he makes here, but this is not like the other Art Scroll books, which are hagiography. This is real biography. It even has pictures of all the heretics, and it's a fine, fine book. He's also the one that published the collected halachic writings of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. So I want to deal with him. I want to deal with the Maharam Shik. But let me tell you something else. Rav Bamberger, he had lots of sons. I don't know if they all were rabbis, but many of them were rabbis. And one son was Yitzhak Zekel Bamberger. He served as the first dayan in Hirsch's community. And he actually separated from the general community. So sometimes people say they portray it as if the son was a bit of a rebel. I don't know if he's a rebel or not, because his father never said you couldn't separate. He said you don't have to if you don't want to, but he never said you couldn't. He himself said that the secession law is a great blessing. There's a rumor, there's an anonymous booklet that came out defending Hirsch against Bamberger, and there was a rumor that it was written by Bamberger's son. Is that possible? Is that true? I don't know. As far as I know, there's no evidence of that. But when I was in Frankfurt, I took a picture of something. Let me pull it up now. They were obviously redoing his grave, as you see the things around it. This is very close to where Hirsch is buried. Hadayin HaMumcha, the Kol Ha'Anos Yishurim, the Frankfurt Am Main, where Yitzhak Zekel Bamberger, he's called Zekel Bamberger, the son of Hagaon Marina Rav Yitzhak Dov HaLevi Bamberger, and it says who his father-in-law was. And it's not the this is not the only person in Bamberger's family that was in separatist communities. So here you see that really a crossover, despite the fact what I said is absolutely true, that there were negative feelings about Rabbi Bamberger remained by the really the burning, the Verbrennte Hirschians. As far as I know, they never forgave Bamberger. Never forgave Bamberger for contradicting Hirsch, for coming into the community, for pulling rank, all these things, as far as I know. Okay, so let me end here. And like I said, we'll pick up with next class. We're going to do next week. We'll do Klugman. We'll do the Maram Shek. Then I'm going to introduce you to Reb Mordechai Levi Horovitz, the Mate Levi. And we'll see his tshuva. Because remember, we said that the community in Frankfurt, the general community, agreed to invite an Orthodox rabbi, a real rabbi. That rabbi is going to be Mordechai Halevi Horovitz. And his own teacher, Israel Hildesheimer, is a religious separatist. But Mordechai Halevi Horovitz feels it's his obligation to accept this Rabbonus, and will read what he says and everything the community agreed to, and the Haskama he gets from his own teacher in Hungary to this step that drove Hirsch crazy, as we'll see. And then I hope to take the story to the end, to the war. With the successor rabbis in the general community. And then I want to move into Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski. We'll see what's going on in Hungary, where the exact same issue is taking place. And then we'll bring it up to America. And this will take us probably another two, three classes dealing with separatism. We'll cover the whole separatist dispute. And then we're going to return to Rabbi Bamberger. Some very interesting tshuvos he wrote, halachic stuff, other things he said, not relevant at all to the separatist dispute. So I don't know how many more weeks it's going to take us. I'll be here next week, and 2 weeks after that, I won't be here, but 3 weeks I'll be here, 4 weeks. As far as I know, I don't have anything at the moment planned in January. So if you're here, I'll be here going straight through. I do want to go to Israel, but I haven't picked the time yet. So let me get to the questions or comments. Hadassah says that her niece went to Beis Yaakov and they only have religious teachers. So you're saying in Beis Yaakov, for the secular subjects, they only have religious teachers. Okay, that is interesting to know. Beis Yaakov Brobart. If anyone else can testify to that in other places, but this person who replied to me, he lives in Lakewood and his kids all go to the Haredi schools there. And he himself works in a Haredi school in Muncie. And he says he doesn't know anything about that. And I'm assuming his daughter, he's talking about his daughter's schools also. So are there other Beis Yaakovs who do that as well? iPad says, isn't the reality that the Orthodox community, especially the more extreme right when you go, use more in money resources than they contribute by a large amount? Indeed, it is. In places where the Orthodox community takes money from the federations, they do, but that will change. In Baltimore, they say that today a majority of Baltimore is Shomer Shabbos. If anyone's from Baltimore, you can actually you do usually
And
have one from
not just
Baltimore.
that.
Yeah,
You
that's true.
were talking about Israel and
Well,
how can
Israel.
their tax dollars go to Chilani schools? And I'm saying the reality is it's the secular majority which subsidizes them. And I have
Okay, but the
relatives
thing.
in Israel who are telling me that they can see the future for their kids not in Israel, precisely because they see the shrinking secular majority. Increasingly needing to subsidize the Orthodox. And he says, there's no future for my kids if that continues in the trend
Okay,
that it is now.
that's certainly a different issue. I raised the other question. What happens if there's, let's say, 60% Orthodox, 70% Orthodox? And a minority of non-Orthodox, then the issue is going to be, is our Orthodox tax money going to have to support the, because I'm assuming that if the Orthodox are majority, they will be working and they'll be productive in the labor market. You're not going to have 30% secular supporting it, but let's just assume that that's going to be the case. Then you're going to get the halachic issue, which doesn't apply in a place like Frankfurt, that what are the Orthodox going to do with their money? So they'll figure something out, I guess, where our money, the majority, will not go to support the non-Orthodox. But let's say you get a situation you could see, let's say, in a small town
I
where
think
the
you're overthinking
non-Orthodox.
it. With respect, I think you're overthinking it. If Israel becomes 60 or 80% majority Orthodox, the state will collapse.
Okay, well, if I'm just okay, but I'm saying, assuming that doesn't happen, if you're in a town, let's say, where you have a majority Orthodox and a small, and they want to have one school of non-Orthodox, the school can't survive without the Orthodox supporting it because the tax money from the non-Orthodox won't be enough. So that's going to be the big halachic issue. What are they going to do now? Can Israel survive? You can be an optimist or a pessimist, and I'd rather go through life being an optimist. And my feeling is, and if anyone reads Yehoshua Pfeffer, he's a colleague of my wife at Tikva. He writes a lot about this and others. I believe that the Haredi community is the way they are because they're able to be the way they are because of agreements and political deals that were made. But when it comes a point, they're going to eventually reach the point where they're going to have to work. They're going to have to go to the army. And we don't know what's going to be after this war. We now have thousands of Haredim in the army, and these are not losers or anything. I'm told that these are real yeshiva students. So whenever you have an event like this, afterwards, society changes in all sorts of ways. So I like to be a pessimist, and I assume that there will be moderation, and we are not going to reach a point that there's going to be religious discrimination and persecution of the irreligious. And yes, if you take the reality of some in the Haredi world today and imagine that they were the majority, not only the irreligious, the modern Orthodox Jews would have to leave because they also would be discriminated against, and it would be a terrible way to live. But that's not going to happen because, in my opinion, because these things have a way of working themselves out, and the Haredi world will become more moderate, the Chiloni world will become more traditional. They'll work out something. So I don't believe, I'm hopeful that we'll never reach that place. Someone privately says he's not sure of the policy, but based off of a borough park, a policy based on a borough park, but Rabbi Hellman, the principal, before going to Mir and part of Shanghai, was a Talmud of Rabbi Breuer in Frankfurt. So it could be that based off of a borough park is adopting this Frankfurt type of approach that we see the Frankfurt approach because of the first principle. Interesting. And someone privately says Yaakov Katz was a Ben Bais in the home of Yitzhak Breuer. He was very, very close to them. And when he goes to Israel, he gets married by he because he's an Agudas. He gets married by it was Rav Dushinsky then. I think it was Rav Dushinsky did his wedding because that's what Agudistan did. They associated with the Eda Haredi. So Yaakov Katz in his essays can really give an inside look, and in his memoirs, autobiography, he also discusses these matters. Gershon asks, would Bamberger have called here Shamshon or Shimshon? Shamshon. No, he would have called, as Naftali has already pointed out. I didn't even realize this, that the name was Shamshon. He was called up to the Torah with the name Shamshon. That was his name. So he would have called him Shamshon. Paul says, the drift of this argument, only I, Hirsch, termed Erecheretz, can rescue this generation, would seem to resonate with the assessment of Hirsch in Noah Rosenblum's book that he saw himself as a modern Rambam, the savior of the time. Indeed, I would agree with you, Paul. Now, the Rosenblum book is a very problematic book because it has a lot, for whatever reason, Noah Rosenblum, also wrote a book on the Malbim. He had an axe to grind. I can't explain why. And Mordechai Breuer reviewed the book and points this out. But all you have to do is read it, you see it. Like when he speaks about separatism, he talks about how when the law was changed and you could separate, he says this gives the opportunity for all the malcontents. He actually uses the word malcontents who want to separate and make trouble. He is so prejudiced against Hirsch. I don't understand it. I mean, I get it. If he was living in Frankfurt 150 years ago and he's on the other side, I can't understand it. But he does make that argument that he's the savior of his time, and I happen to agree that Hirsch was the savior of the time. Once Tarnder Heretz gets going, there's very little in the way of attrition. Where Rosenblum is wrong is his comparing him, is that when he compares him to the Rambam. Hirsch saw himself as the savior, 100%. But the idea that he's the second Rambam, what does Rosenblum say? Rosenblum says, well, what did the Rambam write? He wrote Igaret Teman, Letter to the South. Hirsch publishes a book anonymously called The 19 Letters. As Rosenblum says, and he has a Hebrew title, if you look on the title page, Igrot Safon, Letters of the North. And therefore, he goes off into a few pages psychologizing that, he sees himself as the new Rambam, just like the Rambam wrote Letter to the South, he's writing a letter to the North, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this always bothered me from the time I read the Rosenblum book, because if you read the 19 letters, you know that the Rambam is the one figure that Hirsch attacks in such a harsh way that he never again returns to these attacks. The figures that the Hirsch admires is Yehuda Levi, the Ramban, but not the Rambam. So why would he model himself after the Rambam? And then Mordechai Breuer in Tradition publishes review, and he points out that Rosenblum missed a letter, a German letter that Hirsch wrote, in which he transliterates the title. And the title is not Igrot Safon, Letters of the North, to the North. The title is actually Igrot Safun, Letters of the Hidden One, because the book was written anonymously under a pseudonym. So the few pages of Rosenblum psychologizing that Hirsch is making himself into the new Rambam, and through the title, it all falls apart because of a dot. Is it on top of the Vav or in the middle of the Vav? It's not Letters of the North, it's Letters of the Hidden One. But the larger point, that he's the savior of the generation, I think he's justified in saying that. From Hirsch's standpoint, at least consciously, it's not I'm the savior of the generation. Torah im derech eretz is the savior of the generation, and I'm spreading Torah im derech eretz. So someone says to me, Roy Kugman grew up in Washington Heights. Like I said, I'm very, very impressed with his book. He cites all the sources, the academic sources. He cites liberalists also. I don't know if there's any other art scroll books that are intellectually honest. That doesn't mean that every art scroll book is dishonest in actually saying things which are false. I wouldn't say that. Sometimes you have that. I've given some examples, but generally not. But they cite the truth, but not like we say when we take an oath at court, not the whole truth. That is, they leave out a lot, and they don't discuss uncomfortable things. So you get a truth, but it's not a complete truth, and it's the truth they want you to know, which, since it's not the complete truth, it really isn't a truth. It's a skewed version. Klugman, it's an absolute truth. I give him, I don't know who I should give more shkoyach to, him, or that Art Scroll actually allowed themselves to publish a book, which is an authentic historical work, with pictures of all of people who they wouldn't want to have it. David says, in the schools that were attended by my children, this was true for all the Mamachti Dati elementary schools, but you're saying they had, religious teachers. He said, but not the case with the high schools they attended, although the non-religious men were required to wear kippot, just as Chioni attorneys who appear in Beistin are required to wear kippot. Well, what you're saying, David, according to at least what Ben, unless you're contradicting Ben, Ben's point was, he also said he doesn't know if they insist on it, but he says at least the rule is that, that at least according to the rules, they are required to sign a declaration stating that they live a dati life. So are you saying, David, are you saying that in the high schools today, they just let this fall by the wayside? They don't require this, or they sign it and they don't follow it? If you could provide more insight into, do they just ignore this? Obviously, there's a difference. If they make them sign the declaration and they don't follow it, that's pretty bad. But if they just ignore the declaration, David, are you there? Or do you know what the story is?
Yeah. Look at my next reply. There is, as of 2015, there is a declaration.
Oh, so as of 2000, so you're saying before 2015, this wasn't required, it seems.
Correct.
You say that this policy has been heavily criticized. It hasn't been struck down. So again, the question is, if we have people in Israel, we have only true believers like David, and today someone else who's privately emailed me are listening live, but I have a lot of people listening in Israel when it goes up. So I would love to know, and Ben, if you can find anything more about this, if this is actually enforced, that is, if they enforce the declaration you have to sign, and if they do that, do they enforce that they have to actually be religious, or maybe they don't enforce the declaration? You do say it wasn't enforced by the high schools attended by your kids, but that would have been before 2015, perhaps, including Yeshivas Chorev, you say, which comes out of the German Orthodox. And you say that your son developed a friendship with his Arab teacher of Arabic. Well, and that's not a problem, but the secular math teacher. The secular math teacher wore a kippah, but the secular teacher wasn't religious. He was secular. I don't know, David. Maybe they tell the secular teachers that you can't let anyone know you're secular. You have to let them, you have to, just like I can imagine that in certain Orthodox schools in America, an intermarried teacher, they might say to them, we don't want you to tell anyone that you're intermarried. Just keep it to yourself. Or for that matter, if you have a gay teacher, there are Orthodox schools. It's funny because I think that pretty much every Orthodox school would hire a secular teacher, as Mechal Shabbos, Nitzan Yom Kippur. I bet you there's a lot of Orthodox schools that would not hire a gay teacher. I think today they would all hire intermarried teachers. But you can imagine if they did hire a gay teacher, they would say, please don't speak about your, if it's a man, your husband or your partner or whatever. The question as to is this really consistent? If we can hire teachers who are intermarried, who are completely irreligious, but we're going to say we're not going to hire teachers who are gay, some would say that this is homophobic, and it doesn't. Others would say no. It's look, at the end of the day, a teacher who's completely irreligious, but you know their family, they have a family like everyone else. So that's different than presenting the kids with an alternative model of family. I can actually see both sides on that. Okay, so someone privately says, I'm not sure I can say the Hirschians do not forgive, because as I said, Bamberger's progeny were influential members of the Breuer community. But my point is, to the person who wrote this, did they ever forgive Bamberger, that is the Gaon, the Yad HaLevi, Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger? Clearly, we know that there were members of the family that continued, that were part of the Hirschian community. But did they ever forgive Bamberger for what he did, or was this always a point of polemics? Always, how Bamberger was wrong, he never should have done this, etc. That was my understanding, that whenever the name of Rav Bamberger came up, it always was Nebuch. How could he do such a terrible thing to our community? Which if that's not true, I'd be impressed. But I don't know. David says, of course, Jerusalem today is overwhelmingly Orthodox, and the secular schools financed by the Municipality of Jerusalem are still well-funded. You're right. It's a good point. So the Orthodox in Jerusalem, what is their justification for funding? The issue is, David, are the tax dollars of the secular enough to fund their schools? Or is it such that their tax dollars are not enough? The state of Israel funds all sorts of things not in accord with Torah. I think the rubber hits the road when you can actually say that secular dollars are not enough to fund these secular things. It could be that we haven't reached that yet. But because when we do reach it, then you can be sure that the Agudas Yisrael is going to say, we have a problem. Because the whole justification for Agudas Yisrael is that they get more than they give. That was when I lived in Scranton, all the Orthodox gave money to the Federation there, which you don't find in many other places. And I was told the justification is because we get more than we give. Paul says that Klugman is alleged to have censored some of the content of Shemesh Merapah. He censored one thing, to my knowledge, just one. And that is Hirsch's letter on Agadah. Hirsch wrote a letter on Agadah and, the non-binding authority nature of it, and how the science in the Talmud is not obligatory, although that sort of thing. And Rabbi Schwab, who funded it, he was the one who funded the publication. This is a story as I know it. I've seen it in print. He said not to publish it. He said to Klugman that you'll get yourself in trouble and no need to. That's as far as I know, because my recollection is, although I got to check this now, we're going to read Hirsch's letter. The great irony is the separatist dispute in Hungary. Hirsch comes to defense of the status quo, the ones who were put in Chevron by the Orthodox. I can't remember if that, I think that letter is in the Shemesh Merab. So I don't know of anything else that was censored. Remember, these are halachic essays that the Hirschian community in Washington Heights in the collected writings, they censored the Hirsch's Schiller speech. You might recall. So then I published a translation of it. And then once I published it, well, then they were able to publish it also in the seventh or eighth volume of the collected writings. And if you recall, in the Torah Mana journal, one of the leaders of the community wrote in saying, no, we didn't censor it. We didn't publish it, even though Gertrude Hirschler did it, because we still had people, survivors, and they would have felt very troubled by it and very upset to see how Hirsch writes about Germany, a German thinker in such exalted terms. But that's exactly the point. It's precisely because of that that they didn't publish it. Isn't that censorship? I thought that's what censorship means. I never said there wasn't a reason why they, obviously, every time you censor, there's a reason. I just pointed out the perhaps uncomfortable fact that of all the important things Hirsch wrote, that they chose not to publish, even though Gertrude Hirschler translated it. So I didn't have access to the translation. I published a translation, not the greatest in German, but I did it, and then I had someone else help me a great deal, and then I touched it up. Right now, you don't need my translation because you have Gertrude Hirschler, who's an expert translator. But I can say that it was, I refuse to believe that had I not published it, that they ever would have published it. So the fact that I published the translation, now it's already out there, and the world could see what Rav Shamsher Raphael Hirsch said about Schiller. 100th anniversary of what was it, of his birthday. I think it's amazing. But and if you don't want to pay the money for the collected writings, just go on the Torah Mada journal on YU Torah, and you can see the translation. Now, someone privately says that Art Scroll in general is written for today's generation. Biographies do not and cannot reach the level of essays, Rabbi Jung's leaders' books. Shame they're not reprinted. And regarding the allegation. Against, it's not an allegation. Rabbi Schwab himself told Lawrence Kaplan that he said to Klugman not to, that it should not be included because he'll get himself in trouble publishing this. This piece by Rabbi Rosham Sharfa Hirsch was published in Hamayan by Professor Breuer. So during the whole Slifkin dispute, Slifkin pulled out what Hirsch said. Hirsch wrote it to this, really this religious extremist named Hille Wexler. He was like a very interesting character in Germany, and he was a real, I don't know, fundamentalist. I don't know what you want to call it, a very pious Orthodox Jew who was insisting on certain dogmas. And Hirsch replied to him that that's not true, that when the sages of the Talmud speak science, they're just reflecting, the most advanced science of their day. And so Slifkin pulls this out as a justification. How can you ban my books? Hirsch says this. And the response to him was that one of the Rabbanim actually said this explicitly. It might have been, I think, Rav Moshe Shapiro said it's a forgery. Hirsch never could have said that. But one of the other Rabbanim, I don't know if it's Rav Aaron Feldman or another one, said Hirsch is not part of our Masorah. That is, we're not. Just because Hirsch says something doesn't give it legitimacy because he's not in our Masorah. Okay, that's a bit of a strange thing to say after all. Here it is. Isn't this the ultimate symbol of acceptance in the Haredi world that you have an Art Scroll biography? Isn't this the best proof that Hirsch is in the canon of Gedolei Yisrael? And they want him in the canon. Look, they have so many Gedolim, but they want Hirsch also. And why not? It's not so difficult. Hirsch has he has three principles, right? The two super big ones, separatism, Ausstritt, and the other term Derech Eretz. And he also has anti-Zionism. So if you're in the Haredi world, fine, term Derech Eretz is a bit of a problem, but the other two out of three ain't bad. You can definitely accept these religious separatism. Even not in the communal sense, like in Israel, but basically that we have nothing to do with the non-Orthodox in any other sense. And obviously anti-Zionism fits in well with them. So someone says that privately that the letter in Haggadah is included in the collected writings of Hirsch. in translation. I didn't even know that. Okay, very good. And yes, Adasa says there was a case of an Orthodox school that fired a teacher when they found out the teacher was trans. That was one of the Syrian schools. Yeah. Yes, I didn't remember about the Agadah. Definitely the Shu'er that I knew, or maybe I knew about the Agadah letter, was translated in volume 9. I have volume 9 upstairs. I must have known this and forgot about it, but it's not in the Krugman, book. Okay, I want to thank you all for coming out. We went a little longer tonight, but obviously the topics of interest, I don't know if we spoke more about Bamberger or Hirsch, but they go together. You can't have one without the other. So I don't know, is Rabbi Kelman still with us?
I'm here. I don't know, Paul, do you want to say something? I know you've had your hand up for a long time.
I wanted to give, if I may.
Yes, I was just saying, sorry, Paul, I saw the hands, but I forgot about you. Yes.
That's okay. Just a quick comment about teachers. In Chutz Laaretz, the from schools, the Haredi schools that teach general studies do not have a supply of frum teachers, because for 50 years, frum kids have been told you can't go to university and you can't study secular subjects. Therefore, there is a great shortage of frum teachers, and they have to employ either Balei Tshuva or non-frum teachers. In Israel, with institutions like Bar Ilan, the situation is not nearly as bad.
Why do you say they can employ non-Jews? You're talking about only in Israel, or in America? They can employ non-Jews.
In the States, yeah, they can employ non-Jews, but if they tend to rely on Balei Tshuva or non-frum teachers, because they have no frum teachers. The supply of frum teachers for secular subjects is more or less, or yeshivish teachers, let's say, for secular subjects is more or less disappeared.
You know, I think they would prevail in court, because the religious school can make the claim that we need role models and therefore we can't have non-religious Jews, but it definitely could lead to a lawsuit, because you're not, you know, you hire a non-Jew, but you don't hire a non-religious Jew. That's definitely room for a lawsuit. And although I think they would
believe me, that's not the only issue where they're vulnerable to lawsuits.
Well, in the United States, if it was a religious school, they'd probably win. I mean, the school would win.
Yeah, because they could claim that it's important for role models, yeah, things
as
like that.
As long as they're a religious institution, not registered at an educational institution, as YU found out.
Yes, that's what you found out. Yeah. But thank you, Paul. Yes. Yeah. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, final words.
Yeah, the only thing is, I know from a long time ago, I don't see you discussing American separatism in 2 or 3 weeks. That's a much longer topic.
I thought I said we have 4 or 5 more classes.
No, but you said you discussed the American, I think. That was just a little aside. Okay.
No, they don't have that much about the American situation. More okay. The German is much more interesting than American. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Synagogue Council of America, New York Board of Rabbis, and Reb Soloveitchik.
We'll see. I'm looking at Yaakov Yellen. I don't know if you were here last week, Yaakov. But as soon as we finish with this, I'm at 5, 6 weeks, whatever, 7, whatever it's going to be, we're going right into the Mussar movement.
Yes,
and
I heard
thanks
you mention
to you.
That. Thank you.
Thanks
I heard
to
you.
You're the one who gave me the encouragement, and looking forward to that.
Me too.
Okay. Yes, it is late, so we'll let everybody go. I mean, where Rabbi Yellen is, it's pretty early, because but everywhere else on the East Coast, it's nice and late. So wish everybody Chanukah Sameach, wish you their good news. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman on Kohelet, our next year, and everybody be well, and we look forward to seeing you all next week, okay, and sooner. Laila Tov.
Chanukah
Sameach. Bye-bye.